Thought Leadership from PwC.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in to the next episode of our What's Trending in SEC Comments series, a show all about the major themes we're seeing in, surprise, SEC comment letters. Each episode, a PwC National Office partner joins me to walk us through key comments for consideration as part of your year-end financial statement process. And as I always like to remind private companies, although these are comments from the SEC, so perhaps they're not directly applicable, it's definitely food for thought as you prepare your own financial statements. Up next, cost of sales and inventory.
The tension point is creating a picture of perhaps a sales less a cost of sales number that isn't as inclusive as it should be and therefore implies perhaps a more efficient operation or, you know, sort of better leverage on those revenues than might really be the case.
That's my guest, Pat Durbin. Pat's joining me to talk about a variety of comments we're seeing around cost of sales and the related accounts, from SX Rule 503 to income statement geography and more. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. Pat, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you on today and very interested in our topic because I know we're going to be focused on cost of sales and related accounts. And it's something you and I talked about for the Q3 webcast. But prior to that, I don't think it's something that's really been really top of mind. So why has this become such a hot topic right now?
Thanks, Heather. Thanks for having me back. I think it's a couple of things. I think we don't have a lot of gap to work with. That's not really new. But I think it's really a lot of the types of companies we're seeing come to the market now, maybe through the IPO space or the SPAC space, particularly in more, I'll say, technology-driven businesses where maybe less focus on tangible products or delivery of tangible products creates a little bit more ambiguity in terms of how you really think about cost of sales in particular, and then also some of the other costs and expenses in those businesses and really where they end up on the income statement.
So Pat, so we don't lose some of our listeners who are thinking, I'm in a mature company, this doesn't apply to me. I'm assuming even though the questions are sort of coming from that direction, that doesn't mean other companies can be complacent about this topic.
That's definitely true. And I think you start with the premise that we know the income statement's a really important performance statement for investors. Revenue is obviously a critical measure. Cost of revenue is also a critical measure because it informs how you think about margins or operating leverage. And so those principles are critical and present no matter whether you're sort of a old traditional commercial industrial company, as the SEC would describe it, or a, you know, newer technology-enabled company. Those are still really important metrics. And so we're seeing comments in all those spaces. I think the driver for the increase is really maybe more around some of this more recent activity in the markets.
Very helpful clarification. So then with that sort of level setting, what types of questions are we seeing from the staff? And specifically, what are the areas of more, I'll call it, confusion?
Yes, I think it's in a few areas. I mean, certainly cost of sales and what's in cost of sales. And I think in particular, like the completeness of cost of sales. So are there costs that are maybe not included in that line item that maybe really should be associated with cost of sales? I think we see some questions in that regard. I think we see some questions around what I'll call non-traditional income statement line items. So, you know, maybe in the good old days, you had cost of sales, selling, general administrative expenses, and other. You see a lot more companies using descriptions like technology development, technology operations, operations and support, things that are meaningful in their context, but maybe not widely understood, maybe not well disclosed in terms of what's in there. And so I think we see the staff asking some questions in that space as well.
So then, Pat, I think that's helpful context, but then are we seeing any related comments on the balance sheet or anything related perhaps to inventory?
Definitely not nearly as prevalent. Obviously, inventory tends to be associated with cost of sales, so we think of them in this context. But fairly limited comments in this space. If there are some, it's going to be around if you have any key judgments or perhaps you're making a change in your inventory costing methodology. Maybe you've got a net realizable value question, so you made some estimates there, and just making sure the disclosures are clear in that space. But nothing that I would say is pervasive in the inventory context.
All right. So then let's go back to cost of sales. And specifically, as soon as you said completeness, I think the auditor and me kind of perked up. I guess if we're thinking about completeness, what are some of the sort of foundational things we should be thinking about, and what types of expenses should companies be including in their cost of sales?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, cost of sales is an important metric. I think if you look at the guidance in the SEC's rules, it's Regulation SX Rule 503. It has very limited minimum disclosure requirements. So it's cost of sales, other operating expenses, and SG&A, essentially. So I think there's a perspective that cost of sales in that context is sort of an expansive concept. Maybe if we think of it in the traditional sense of cost of goods sold, we know that that includes not just the direct costs, things like labor and materials, but it also includes an allocation of indirect costs, depreciation, manufacturing supplies, other consumables, maybe some warehousing utilities. All those things are really critical ingredients, ultimately, even though they may not vary by the individual unit. So you need to think broadly about what's in cost of sales. So I think that's the concept that underlies some of these questions around, hey, are there things that maybe are somewhere else in the income statement that really belong in cost of sales? Because I think the tension point is creating a picture of perhaps a sales less a cost of sales number that isn't as inclusive as it should be, and therefore implies perhaps a more efficient operation or, you know, sort of better leverage on those revenues than might really be the case.
So, Pat, one point of clarification, I was just thinking. So you mentioned previously, I think, that there's a requirement to show this cost, some concept of cost of revenue or cost of sales. But then I know in the past we've talked a little bit about gross margin, and you're not required to show that subtotal, right? Is, can you clarify there?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not a required disclosure or presentation, rather, under the SEC rules. But importantly, as you noted, sales and cost of sales, which are the two components of what is gross margin, are required. And so I think the perspective is whether you show the subtotal or not, the income statement needs to provide clearly the sales and the cost of sales that the user of the financial statement, the investor, then can determine what the gross margin is.
Okay, I think that's helpful. And I guess just curious from a practice perspective, any sense for if people typically do show sort of that subtotal or not, or just depends on industry and particular practice?
Yeah, I think it definitely varies depending on industry. It certainly would have been fairly common in a traditional product-based business, maybe even in a sort of traditional service-based business where it really depends on full time and delivering the service. But as we evolve into more of these technology-enabled businesses where maybe there's less direct marginal costs to generate revenue, maybe a little bit of a shift away from that, but it still tends to vary, and there isn't really any common theme or thread that you...
All right. So then if we take a step back and think about sort of the diversity in practice, which I think is where some of these questions are coming from, anything in particular where we're seeing that diversity or particular types of costs where these questions are honing in?
Well, I will say the one that is probably the most prevalent, so that's going to drive maybe more commentary there, but probably not really the thing where we're seeing the most current increase, but it is still a very prevalent topic, and that's in the area of shipping and handling costs. Been diversity in practice for years as to whether some companies do include that in cost of sales, some don't. They include it in some other line, maybe in an SG&A line. When the new revenue standard was issued here a few years ago, it put a little bit more focus on this area because, as a premise, the revenue standard might suggest that those activities, shipping and handling, meaning the efforts needed to get your goods to the customer, really are another promise to the customer independent of the goods. Now, ultimately, there's a policy election in the standard that allows you to conclude that those activities are really just a cost of fulfilling the delivery of the good, and some ensuing dialogue, SEC staff speech around if you had a historical policy of including those shipping and handling costs outside of cost of sales, that was likely okay to continue. If you had an historical policy of including those in cost of sales, that was likely okay to continue. But I think a pretty clear steer that if you have them in cost of sales, and now we're thinking about maybe moving them out of cost of sales, I think they would struggle to view that as a preferable change.
All right. And I think it's a good reminder, Pat, we've talked before about preferability, that even classification, you know, you have to think about preferability before you're moving around your classification.
And I would say that's certainly the case when you're talking about what I'll call one of these important line items on the income statement. So something that's in cost of sales being moved out or vice versa, you know, because of the impact on that important metric, gross margin.
All right. So then, Pat, let's move on then and talk about operating expenses, because that's obviously in some ways the corollary of cost of sales. Are we seeing comments on those types of expenses as well?
Yes. And I think what I alluded to earlier, particularly around the use of some of these non-traditional captions, if you look at the SEC guidance, again, it gives you very limited choices, sort of selling, general, administrative, or other, effectively. Now, those aren't very descriptive, and there's no prohibition to using more descriptive lines or even maybe different terminology for some of those lines. And you see that even with the required ones. But when you're using some of these newer or non-traditional descriptions, I think the question necessarily becomes, okay, what is in there? And so if you don't have good, clear disclosure of what's in those lines, I think the staff, because all they really have to work with is kind of what's presented or what's there, they may ask, okay, what's in that line? But a view being, do you have costs in some of those lines that really do belong in cost of sales? Again, particularly when you're dealing with some of these companies where maybe the direct marginal cost of generating revenue is not very significant at all. Think about a company perhaps that provides access to its software via a cloud or software as a service platform. The platform exists, it's running, generating an additional, you know, license or a contract to use that software doesn't have any marginal cost, but that doesn't mean the company has zero cost of sales. So you have to think about what are the costs that are necessary really to generating that revenue when you're using some of those non-traditional lines. And you might see something like that when companies are using technology operations, platform operations, technology support. It's sort of really getting at, okay, well, what's in there? And are those costs really something that I should be associating with revenue?
So then, Pat, what do you see as best practices in terms of disclosing these amounts? So it makes sense, I think, your comment that, okay, if you're using a different description, then I'm assuming it's in your accounting policy footnote that you would explain what's in there. And is it a laundry list of the costs, or how do you see people doing that? I mean, and maybe if it's in response to an SEC comment too.
Well, I think that's probably best practice would be to disclose what's in those lines. I would say, in fairness, just like we have very little gap on what should be on the income statement, we also have very little explicit guidance on what should be disclosed. And probably as an observation on what's actually happening in practice, there's not detailed, robust disclosure of the components of some of these line items on the income statement. So I think that's largely what's happening in practice, but it's probably also what's largely driving some of these comments. And if you're looking to avoid getting some of those comments, then I think clear, transparent disclosure of some of those judgments and decisions you made about what you put on the income statement would be very useful. I mean, you can start with the premise that, okay, there's not explicit GAAP, but if I'm choosing to call something on the income statement, there has to be some underlying thought process or rationale to that. So let the reader know how you thought about it. And I think that would go a long way to probably alleviating some of those questions.
And when we see these comments, is the typical response that, okay, I'll add more disclosure, or do we see things getting reclassified, or it's some combination of those?
I think it could be either or both, some combination of additional disclosure and potentially some instances where costs have had to be reclassified and or at least perhaps further disaggregated.
All right. So then on that topic of reclassification, we touched briefly on this preferability issue, but let's say, again, I'm a company and maybe my business is changing or I'm growing, or there's lots of reasons why I might want to move some costs around. So what should I be thinking about if I do want to reclassify costs within, let's say, operating expenses and cost of sales? Or between, I guess I should say.
Yes, so I think certainly if you're talking about something that affects cost of sales and some other line, you need to think about that through the lens of the guidance on changes in accounting principle, which is ASC 250 and preferability. So that's point one. If you're talking about maybe just a further disaggregation of items, perhaps within SG&A, maybe you want to break that out, or perhaps even within cost of goods sold, if you want to break it out between maybe your direct product costs and some other costs, I think that disaggregation is sort of acceptable. You don't really have to go through the preferability hoops. But if you're really moving costs between these meaningful categories, you need to think through it like change in accounting principle.
And then, Pat, maybe a related question I think, you know, you and I have both seen is often something starts immaterial. And so it kind of gets put wherever it gets put. And then as it becomes more and more material, then there's always this question of when do I move it? How do I move it? How do I think about some of these questions? So any particular advice other than maybe making sure you're thoughtful up front? But
certainly being thoughtful up front is always going to be helpful. Clearly, the guidance contemplates situations where you have immaterial items and you're not really choosing an accounting policy until they become material. So there's that judgment you have to make as well. But otherwise, you're going to get into the question of, well, what was what I was doing previously acceptable or not? And then if what I'm proposing to do now, does it rise to the level of a change in accounting? So it's, I would say, a judgmental area, particularly given the lack of explicit GAAP. There's going to be a lot of judgment in determining whether something even is a change in accounting principle or not in this space, and going to depend a lot too on the specific circumstances of the company. So hard to give you a real crisp answer on that one.
Yeah, other than I do think your probably point is keep an eye on this and don't just let amounts kind of keep sliding by, but make sure you know what's in these various accounts so you are making a choice at the right point in time.
Yep.
All right. So then, Pat, another question you mentioned earlier, there's questions around allocation of indirect costs, and in particular, sort of which are operating expenses and which how much should go into cost of sales. And I think this costs, like, say, depreciation and amortization. So anything particular in that area that companies should focus on?
Yeah, so this is an interesting area. I would say there's a practice that's been around forever where some companies will include depreciation and amortization in a separate line item on the income statement. Now, in concept, right, depreciation and amortization, other than being non-cash, you could argue whatever function the underlying asset is performing relates to one of those other things we talked about, cost of sales or selling general administrative expenses. So there's nothing that automatically says, okay, they just belong on a separate line, but they are non-cash. There's a practice that's been out there. The SEC has a specific piece of guidance. It's actually SEC staff guidance and staff accounting bulletin, or SAB, as we call them, SAB topic 11B, which basically says you can do that, but to the extent that you're presenting cost of sales, excluding those amounts, you have to present a description of that on the income statement. So saying it's cost of sales excluding depreciation and amortization, which is shown below. So that's the one specific requirement from a presentation standpoint. In terms of, you know, how to think about the allocation of those costs to the other lines, again, not a lot of explicit GAAP once you get outside of the inventory realm. I mean, there is pretty clear guidance there in terms of how you think about allocating overheads. Depreciation is typically a significant one of those, how you allocate that to your cost of inventory, and that is a GAAP requirement. When you start thinking about, well, just, okay, it's all a period cost, some sort of depreciation or amortization on a maybe a corporate headquarters or some sort of other intangible that I'm using broadly in the business, there's no real guidance on how you think about, does that belong in different line items or not. So again, it's use your judgment. If it's material, make sure you disclose it. And I think even though the SAB topic is really driven at this cost of sales guidance, think about whether it would be appropriate to disclose at least something about where you're putting depreciation and amortization or what it relates to if it is in a separate line.
So then, Pat, let me just clarify something, because we focused here on allocation, but I did hear you say that SAB topic 11B permits a company to explicitly state that cost of sales excludes depreciation, which is shown separately below. So then in that case, you would just put depreciation and amortization in its own separate line if you go down a path of not allocating?
Again, I think that's a practice that's been around and the SEC staff hasn't explicitly rejected it. But if you follow that approach, you do need to follow this guidance, which says you need to specifically present the cost of sales line as indicating it excludes those amounts.
So then the financial statement users, I guess, in theory, could make their own conclusions on that.
Right. And perhaps by default, the implication would be, well, all of that must relate to cost of sales.
Right. Okay. That's helpful. So then, Pat, let's loop back to inventory, because I know that you said we're seeing a lot more on cost of sales, but I also know you like inventory, and I do as well. There's lots to think about there. So any particular comments that we've seen on inventory that you would highlight for companies that, you know, are dealing with that?
I mean, inventory is certainly a pervasive line item for any company. Obviously, it depends on selling products. So you're going to see incidents of comments there, but probably all over the map. I mean, inventory does tend to be one of those areas in GAAP where not only are there alternative acceptable methods of measuring inventory, so you know, FIFO or LIFO or average cost, but also a fair amount of judgment in how you determine what goes into inventory cost. And then you've also got a requirement to think about, is your inventory carried at a realizable or recoverable amount? So you may get into the need for assessing the net realizable value of inventory, which is another judgment. So given those decisions and judgments that you're making, to me, that's always a key consideration when you're thinking about, hey, what should I be disclosing? Like, don't just regurgitate, you know, here's my category of inventory, you know, carry on. It's how did I get to those points? You know, what were the judgments that went into that? So that's kind of what I'd be thinking about, but not a particularly prevalent area of comment recently.
Although I'd say the theme I'm getting from you is disclosure, and being descriptive is probably a solution for many, if not almost all of the comments that you're seeing in both of these areas. So other than that, any other sort of key takeaways or advice that you give to companies as they're preparing, that we're both thinking about inventory, but then preparing their income statement?
It comes back to maybe the point I made earlier, that even though we don't have explicit GAAP, the company or management is making decisions about how to present their income statement and which costs are going in which line item. So there needs to be some rationale underlying that. I think it would be important to explain that to the reader so they can understand it, particularly in those cases where you're using something that looks a bit more unconventional, let's say. And I think that's totally appropriate, because the business models are different than they were when the guidance and regulation as such, Rule 503 was crafted decades ago. We didn't have a lot of the businesses we have today. So I think that's fair, but just be sensitive to that and be thoughtful about it. You also need to be thinking carefully about how you're describing your business outside the financial statements and make sure that at least you're paying attention to the non-GAAP metrics and what their most closely comparable GAAP measure is, right? That's a fundamental premise in non-GAAP reporting. But it then sort of magnifies or puts emphasis on how do I get to the GAAP number, and particularly something like a gross margin, which might be the closest comparable to perhaps contribution margin. The reader needs to know what the GAAP gross margin is, and you need to be able to reconcile to that if you're talking about something like a contribution margin. So that's something you also want to be thoughtful about. And then again, I think it just comes down to ensuring that you're conveying some of those key judgments and decisions you're making to the reader, if not otherwise apparent from the face of the financial statements.
So Pat, actually, I was thinking of this question when we were talking about the allocation of depreciation and amortization. Do you see cases where people are sort of adjusting depreciation and amortization from a non-GAAP perspective, or is that something you really would expect if you're going to be allocating it, that you would be doing it that on the face of the income statement?
Well, certainly one of the most prevalent non-GAAP measures is EBITDA, right, which by definition excludes depreciation and amortization. When you get into some of these other, I'll say, more operational non-GAAP measures, particularly something like contribution margin, again, in a scenario where you've allocated depreciation to your cost of sales, I would expect that's probably not being adjusted there. But again, it's non-GAAP, so you can do what you want. Just make sure you're clear about it. It would just seem to be pretty painful to try to figure out how to do that.
Well, exactly. That's actually why I had the question. So, all right. Well, Pat, as always, very helpful to have you on. But before I let you go, we're now up to my favorite segment. I'm not sure my guests enjoy it as much as I do, but this is to stump my guests. And I will warn you that the team has been coming up with increasingly harder questions. So here's the first one. Who was the president of the United States the year that the SEC began making comment letters public?
I'm going to go Bill Clinton.
So that was my guess too. So I will check and we will do fact checks for the audience. But yeah, I think it's early 90s, right?
Or sounds about right.
Early to mid. Yeah. Fact check. Score 0 for Heather and Pat. We were both a term too early with guessing Clinton. The SEC began releasing comment letters in 2004, dated August 1st, 2004 or later, and the president was George Bush. All right, and then this one, I'm going to be shocked if you know. So who was the Super Bowl winner the year that SAB Topic 11B was issued?
We'll see. If you told me the year SAB Topic 11B was issued, I might have a shot.
All right. Well, I'm looking at what I have here, and I know it was recodified in 2017. So why don't we use that, and then I'll check the real facts for the fact check. So what's your guess for 2017, Pat?
From that time frame, as good a guess as any would be the Patriots, given they were winning pretty much every year at that point.
Yeah, but it was only 4 years ago. So I think you're right, but we'll double check on all of that. Fact check. Pat's safe guess was correct for the 2017 recodification of SAB Topic 11B. That year, the Patriots won the Super Bowl. And if you're wondering who won the Super Bowl the year SAB Topic 11B was issued, the year was 1976. And Pat should have known this one. It was the Pittsburgh Steelers winning their second consecutive Super Bowl. All right. Well, Pat, as always, first of all, thank you for going along with my Stump the Guest questions. Appreciate that. And also definitely appreciate all the insight. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Heather. My pleasure.
That's our show for today. Tune in on Thursday for the next episode in our Talking ESG series. We'll begin our examination of each of the major frameworks that underlie today's ESG reporting, starting with the Global Reporting Initiative, or GRI. And I have a special guest for this episode, the future GRI president. Next week, before you put on your out-of-office message for Thanksgiving break, tune in on Tuesday for our look at SEC comment letter trends in the area segments, and look for our Thursday episode to be bumped up to Wednesday as we continue our ESG series with a deep dive into TCFD standards. So that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all the latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.